Life coaching and discovery. Inspiration with an invitation to learn from a self-discovery guide. Mark is passionate about you making positive changes in your life so that it becomes a vibrant, ongoing journey of growth and discovery. Welcome to the Inspire Possibility Show. Now, here's your host, Mark Susnow.
Hi, everybody. This is Mark Susnow. We're here to present to you different cutting-edge thought leaders, people who are committed to making a difference in the world. And today I have somebody who is a legend in his own time, somebody that has been on public television for years, who's written several books. He's sold over 12 million books about the human condition, about the inner child, about shame. Somebody who is a great teacher, somebody who I'm honored to have, and who has a new book out, and that is John Bradshaw. Welcome, John.
Hey, welcome, Mark. Thank you for having me.
It's my honor.
I really appreciate it and appreciate connecting with you.
Well, I felt really privileged we had some time to talk a little bit before the show started to kind of get to know each other. And I know that some of the work you've done, you had a series that was called Homecoming.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that was about the inner child, and that was more or less at the time. When did this book come out, the Homecoming?
The new book or the
homecoming,
homecoming
one.
Book?
Homecoming.
Homecoming came out in 1991. And fortunately, it was a New York Times bestseller and was number one on the list for 58 weeks, and then it
wow.
stayed on there for 3 years. I mean, it's beyond my comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a 10-year plan. I just was going along trying to take life, what life presented to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because, you know, people can be inspired by that, that you don't have to have a big plan. You just have to be alert to what life's
mm-hmm.
offering you.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've written a lot about that. And
I have,
inspiring
yeah.
people to hope. But anyway, that was nominated for an Emmy. We did the talk show on San Francisco PBS. And, I mean, we did the 10-part series there.
Uh-huh.
And the book was going bonkers. And I was on Oprah, and Oprah came apart on the show. And I wound up going to her farm and doing the workshop with she and her friends. So
uh-huh.
it's been an amazing book. It's in 42 languages now.
Wow.
And I've just been blown away by that. My mother wasn't impressed till she got the Greek version and the Hebrew
uh-huh.
version of the book. You
uh-huh.
know, so whatever.
Uh-huh.
But I'm really excited about this new book because it's got brand new information in it that I think
will
really
help. And the new book
you.
Is, tell us about the new book is, is post-romantic stress disorder. Did I get that right?
Post-romantic stress disorder, what to do when the honeymoon is over. And it presents three new exciting discoveries. Actually, six, but the first half
mm-hmm.
of the book is about the three new, which
mm-hmm.
Help us understand lust and what it is when we talk about being in love. And then
mm-hmm.
what most of us don't know much about is what Helen Fisher, this is the anthropologist at Rutgers, she
mm-hmm.
did studies over a five-year period doing fMRIs,
mm-hmm.
which are studying the brain chemistry of people who were in love and in lust and differentiated those two. And then she found a completely different program called the attachment program. And it's what begins to happen when a couple starts thinking about a baby. Both
uh-huh.
of them sort of move out of the, the passionate state of infatuation and move toward the dopamine, the testosterone sex drug is replaced by vasopressin and oxytocin, which are the cuddle chemicals. And they prepare a woman to have a baby, to have a child, and prepare a man.
Uh-huh.
But what happens is the
so there's a different period, there's a hormonal change when they go from when they want to have a baby, when the both partners want to have that. There's a hormonal change.
Absolutely. And of course,
and does that come? When does that come? Does that come before they work on conceiving, or how does that change?
Well,
happen?
So many couples get pregnant and get married pregnant. I mean, mm-hmm. it's so common as to almost be a laugh. But mm-hmm. a couple could conceivably, you know, get married and say, okay, I want a child. Or some couples wait a couple of years. But whatever it is, when they begin to talk about a child and building a family, the sex drugs, what I call the amazing sex when you're in love,
mm-hmm.
is
mm-hmm.
replaced by the vasopressin and oxytocin is the chemical that's stimulated by a mother nursing her baby. It can also come out of endearing sex. You know, you're having
mm-hmm.
sex and it's an in-love sex and
mm-hmm.
That it's endearing. And so you create oxytocin, which is the cuddle chemical between the two partners.
Uh-huh.
But what happens to a lot of high testosterone men, and there are some women, but they have this rupture when the in love romance program is a complete program. It's innate in the brain. It's much less a passion and more a drive. That nature drives us to a partner, helps us select a partner. That's why in love evolved. Lust is just when you want to have sex with somebody. Now,
uh-huh.
the human race has continued probably because of lust, but still, lust and in love are very different brain states.
Uh-huh.
One, I mean, you
so
can,
what is the
you
brain
can
state
have
of
the
lust,
lust trigger in love or in love trigger lust, but lust in itself is just wanting to have sex with somebody, and usually you want to get out of there when it's done.
Uh-huh.
Men certainly experience that, maybe more than
right.
women. But uh-huh. in love, you don't want to get out of there. You want to stay uh-huh. with your beloved. You don't want your beloved out of your sight.
Uh-huh.
Because you're now in this intense state of infatuation, which, you know, if you look it
right.
up in the dictionary, it's a state of kind of foolish love is what the word
uh-huh.
means, infatuation.
Lust, you were saying?
It lasts. This is a incredible piece that I never knew. It lasts only 18 months. So from 12 to 18 months, this high state of infatuation and what I call the amazing sex when you're in love.
Uh-huh.
And often when you're having an affair, you don't realize that that's just that in love program being fired again. And it's going to end in 18 months. And you're going to be back at whatever your problems was before you started.
Mm-hmm.
So this material helps, you know, it's helped me and a lot of other people. I've done some of this in workshops, but I didn't have all the full anthropological data of the three brain systems. And those are the new discoveries. I mean, people have had a suspicion that when you're in love, the brain is all rivved up with dopamine and norepinephrine
mm-hmm.
and reduced mm-hmm. serotonin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But nobody really, I used to call it the PEA dopamine cocktail. you know, that you're just fired up and you don't ever want to leave their side. And you have energy, you lose weight, you know. You think
so that's
you've
a dopamine
died
serotonin.
On to heaven because of the sex. And, you know, and you say things like, you went to high school and I went to high school. I can't believe it. You know, that
uh-huh.
meet somebody like you and
uh-huh.
say all these things that seem crazy afterwards.
Right, right. So, John, I got a question. So that is that period, the in lust, the infatuation, is that with us with the serotonin and the norepinephrine?
Yeah, the lust and the infatuation are serotonin,
the serotonin
and norepinephrine, which are both neurotransmitters in the brain that stimulate, they just open the door for testosterone. Before in love, the testosterone levels are something. After in love, they're both revved up to a pitch they've not been before. Then when the in-love cycle ends, the partners go back to their normal testosterone level, which usually means that the male has more testosterone, he's more the alpha, and he will be more jolted by the wife saying, after 18 months of spontaneous automatic sex, by the spouse saying, let's just cuddle tonight. I open up the book in the prologue with a couple that I actually had, and that was the beginning. That's what I call the breach. He was a very low self-esteem but high testosterone man, a guy named Paul, or that's my made-up name for him. And he just, I mean, it was traumatizing for her to end their spontaneous automatic sexual patterns. And she said, well, let's talk about it in the morning. They never did. Three years later, they're divorced.
Question. Now, the cuddling, but that's not the same. So the kid with the kid, there's the oxytocin. What about the cuddling? Are there hormones released
with the cuddling?
Well, the cuddling
does trigger oxytocin. I mean, when you're holding and loving your spouse, you are triggering oxytocin. It's the chemical. It's the cuddle chemical, they call it. And I don't know. You know, I'm not a brain expert on this stuff, but I know what these researchers are saying.
Yeah. So if people want to get a hold of you,
that's what I'm trying to say again.
So, yeah. Are you still? Do you still do workshops? And
I still do workshops, and in fact, I'm going to be presenting at two big conferences in February and in March for my publisher and their company. And I'm going to be doing some workshops here in Houston. I've been disabled through a hospitalization and where I thought I was going to die about a year and a half ago. They pronounced that I had COPD and I had a quadruple bypass. And they said, you know, there was some, my heart was out of sinus rhythm. Anyway, it's back in sinus rhythm. And I've already been to a conference in Fort Lauderdale where I presented the book and had great response to it.
So you're in, and so if somebody wanted, let's say a group wanted to have you do a conference, how would they get a hold of you?
Well, I have some addresses they can call. At the end of the book, I have all that outlined. 1-800-6-BRADSHAW. If they dial that 1-800-6-BRADSHAW, the last two,
and they'll get a hold of you.
Well, they'll be in my office there that will take it, and or else they can write me at P.O. Box 667-147, Houston, Texas 77266.
And if they want to get the book,
it's on Amazon. Or they can call my office directly, that 1-800-6-BRADSHAW. The publisher sells it, Health Communications. And I know that Amazon's been selling it. I was telling you earlier, I went and had a root canal and told the dentist he ought to give this book to all his girls in the office. So he bought 15 copies. He bought them right off Amazon that day.
Right.
The book wasn't published yet. But
and how,
it's
when,
now
when
published,
was the...
and Barnes & Noble has it. My former editor called me and she said, I found it on the Barnes & Noble's bestseller shelf. It's certainly not a bestseller yet. I hope programs like this will help me with it. Because it's for young kids. Like it ought to be. This ought to be taught to
like
seniors
us,
in high school and young couples who are going to experience the jolt, and couples who've been together progressively living more and more kind of lives of quiet desperation, where they're like two people bunking in a house, but no real contact. Second part of the book, I have the movie Hope Springs as kind of the metaphor for the whole second half of the book. We just don't have any long-term models of marriage. I mean, we simply have what is in love and the immediacy of in love, but most people don't realize that intensity is, I mean, until you've been through it, you realize
right.
that it ends. And you're kind of left without all that immediacy and passion. And, you know, James Hollis says you can't do therapy with people who are in love because they're crazy. They're out of their minds.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, every guy I know that I counseled along the way, you know, really needed this material, especially these high-rolling CEOs who have girlfriends and think they've found their soulmate in their affair, and they haven't. They've just
right.
gotten back into this frenzied state. And one of the regrets, I didn't write enough about affairs, because people really need to understand it's rarely going to be better with someone else. If you haven't cleaned up your own baggage, it's just not going to
uh-huh.
be any different, ultimately.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah.
I mean, the book is trying to help people stop early divorces, because in studies that have been done with, you know, I think over 100 samples, 50% of American adults thought that in love was directly related to sexual desire. So if you quit having
uh-huh.
that intense sexual desire, it means you don't love this person anymore. I've had
uh-huh.
1,000 men tell me I love my wife, but I'm not in love with her. Well, duh, that's exactly the way nature planned it. That
uh-huh.
the in love is like the booster rocket that gets you into the program.
Uh-huh.
And we know some stuff now about attraction that's amazing, coming
uh-huh.
from heart transplants and how the body can ascertain compatible and incompatible DNA. And DNA is the immune system detective. And there's a thing in the DNA called the human lymphocyte antigen, HLA. And when those profiles are different, there's chemistry between people. That they found in studies, the one famous one of women smelling men's sweaty T-shirts.
Uh-huh.
In any place where a woman said, "I'm really attracted to that smell, I'd like to meet him," they were opposite human lymphocyte antigens. What that means
uh-huh.
is that the chemistry is set up by nature in order for you to have offspring that have immunity to more diseases. You've built up certain immunities out of your family system. She's
uh-huh.
built up immunities, or he or her. And the offspring will maintain more immunities to disease. So, you know, all of our theories of why you're attracted, the love map and imago therapy, I mean, they're okay. They're trying to explain some complicated stuff. But it's really, the first half of my book is called Mother Nature's Old Black Magic. And we have to know what's going on in nature. These are innate programs. And
this is like
the
attraction, the getting together, the mating process.
Yeah, I mean, it can be instant, although it usually isn't.
Uh-huh.
I can remember during my period of being divorced, I had one that just... All of a sudden, I never had this happen when I was doing
uh-huh.
a workshop. This gal was standing in line, and I just had this sense of immediacy.
So
I can't
right.
leave this hotel without her. And, I mean,
right.
it was just crazy. I never experienced
right.
anything so overwhelming. And there was a huge age difference and all of that.
Uh-huh.
Anyway,
that was lust?
No question. We were...
Yeah.
chemically attracted to each other.
Yeah.
So, and that can happen to anyone at any
yeah.
time.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
So how do
couples, and you can
how
lust
couples,
for someone even though you're married and you're happily married and you've got a great friendship. You can still want to have sex with someone. And both
right.
men and women have that. Some will admit it, some won't.
Right. What What percentage of marriages would you say there's infidelity?
Well, in the studies I have, which are from John Gottman and Julie Gottman in Seattle, they have that they have that suite there where couples come, and they're the they've got the best empirical evidence on marriage that I know of. I'll tell you a dramatic piece they came up with recently, but
and I've heard of their work.
In their study, 50% of people are divorcing, but of those that stay together, 17% are unhappy. So that means that only 33% of marriages are working. And I think it, a lot of it is because of ignorance, and people don't realize that when the in-love ends, you got to start working at it. So in the second part of my book, I talk about, you know, from in-love, you go to the family blockade, meaning whatever wounds you're carrying from the past, those are going to clash. Because, see, when you're in love, you don't deal with any of that. In fact, you tend to make the faults of the other person into virtues. I literally had a woman who I'd counseled for over a year. She had been in two abusive marriages. Come in after a year and say, I've met the most wonderful man. And I said, well, tell me about him. Well, you know, on the second date, he told me he'd killed a man. Isn't that marvelous that a guy could be that honest, telling me? And, you know, I almost fell off the chair. But that's that in-love blinders that people get on. You know, she's so cute, she takes 45 minutes to get dressed. Well, wait till you're married. All these cute things sort of dissipate.
I want to first of all remind our listeners, either you're listening to Journey On, a production of Inspire Possibility Media. I'm here with John Bradshaw, who is the author of several books. His new book is the Post-Romantic Stress Disorder, What to Do When the Honeymoon is Over. And what I hear you say is that honeymoon phase, in whether you're married or not, is, according to the research, is going to last about 18 months. 12 to 18 months.
That's it. I mean, now, it doesn't mean if you have fairly solid sense of self, if you have some pretty good self-esteem, in other words, the high-risk population are severely codependent people who lack a real sense of self, and addicts and recovering addicts. I'm 49 years sober from alcoholism, and I've been to meetings for 49 years, and what I hear most talked about is not stopping the drinking, but the relationships they're in and how they can't work out their relationships. And we say people in recovery take hostages. They don't have relationships. So it's a severe at-risk population for post-traumatic stress disorder. And even in recovery, people have terrible times with relationships, both, you know, both friendships and love relationships. So there's stuff we can do about it. The whole second half of the book outlines what are considered by most of us the stages that a marriage is going to go through. And hopefully giving...
So what are some things that couples that are, you know, really feel they love each other, what are some things they can do?
Well, one of the most things, one of the common things I found that was present in a healthy couple is they did new things. In other words, they just didn't get in a rut, although some couples make it just being in a rut. But the vibrant couples that I saw that were growing and changing, you know, they were interested in new things. You told me you changed your whole profession 15 years ago. I mean, that's an amazing thing. That's amazing. And it's going to bring a whole new kind of relationship. And, you know, it may not always be the best or whatever, but it's going to newness. They've shown that couples who have long been out of in love can renew some of that in love by, for example, taking a vacation where neither one of them have been, or just going and doing some, going to hear some lectures together, or going to a workshop together and sharing.
And these are things that really to grow as a person we should be doing anyway, even by ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, you've written brilliantly about change and the challenge of change, but you can't grow without it. You can't go without pain, and you know, your pain has helped you change.
Right. I know when we were talking before, there was a quote that that you had, and I think you said there's a place in our heart that does not yet exist. Is that right?
Pain must be. In other words, the pain we have expands our soul if we don't just completely, you know, identify with it and become the victim for life and all of that. If we can say that pain is there, it's helping me carve out my character of who I am and my strengths. So we need, you know, without a hurt, a heart is hollow. We need that. There are places in the heart that do not yet exist. Pain must be in order that they be. Mm-hmm. So a couple that's growing can capitalize on their troubles from the past and work out reasonable relationships. They may not be the traditional relationships, but they're still relationships.
Right.
And couples can renew their sex life. I saw it in many older couples that came to me. Mm-hmm. I was able to counsel over 700 couples in 20 years of my life. I quit in 1989 when I got on national television and got booked out there, and I just couldn't do it anymore. But I saw people really renew their marriages. And the ones that I saw in that, what I call the last stage, first stage is in love. Second stage is you got to work through your family of origin stuff. Both of you are carrying rules, both overt and covert, from your families. Like, how do you celebrate Christmas? How do you celebrate birthdays? Who's supposed to work in this family? Who isn't supposed to work? I mean, all that is huge conflict as we come into a more and more of equality and democracy in marriages. A lot of men are totally threatened by their wives working or their wives making more money than them. Mm-hmm. So all of that's got to get worked through. And then the third stage is you've got to help each other become the person you were meant to be. You have to be the facilitators of each other's self-actualization. That real love means that I stand by and support and help in any way I can what my spouse is doing and how she's moving on to sort of find her true self. Because if you don't have a self, you can't give yourself to anybody.
Right. That might mean that her finding herself or you finding yourself might mean that you're no longer together in that traditional form.
Absolutely. And couples work that out with, you know, good, they work it out well as adults. Mm-hmm. And it can be painful to one or both the partners, but still, if you're open to growing as a person, because if I am I and you are you, then I am and you are. But if I am not and you are not, then I am not and you are not. A rabbi said that. Mm-hmm. 1596 or something. It's an astonishing quote.
You know, I kind of feel when we're not the person we're supposed to be, we're cheating two people. We're cheating ourselves and we're cheating the other person of not really getting to experience the real me, the real you. You know, we're running out of time, and I want to remind our listeners we've been listening to John Bradshaw, the author of the new book, Post-Romantic Stress Disorder. And again, you can get that book on, probably the easiest way is to get on Amazon, and you can call John, and I believe it's, 1-800-6-BRADSHAW, is that right?
Right. That will get to my office.
Yeah.
People will buy this. It will help long-term marriages. It will help young couples. It will help teenagers understand in love better. Not that it may deter them, but I saw so many terrible things happen with teenage pregnancy, and it's all saturated.
I just want to thank you for you know, for all the work you've done throughout the years. I mean, you're all the things today, we talk about emotional intelligence, we talk about the inner child, we talk about shame, and you were a real pioneer in making these terms more prevalent, making people more aware of these terms and these concepts, and that it was okay to talk about them. And it's okay
I can't deny it. And
yes.
It's been a great journey, just like, but I'm still on it. You know, you and I talked earlier, we're still on it.
Yeah.
And we're getting older, but we're getting wiser.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
So we're going
to
have to wrap up.
You've been a joy, Mark, to talk
well,
to
you too.
And
I was,
share,
such
and
an
I'm
honor.
So happy with what you're doing. I'll be following you too.
Well, thank you. And I just, was a real delight to spend this time together. And
well,
until
anytime,
next week,
I'm happy to share with you because it's a real soulmate kind of thing.
Exactly. And I want to just say that in the meantime, till next week, journey on. Enjoy the journey, everybody, until we talk to the next time.
I believe in motivation. We all talk about change, but we all get sick from telling ourselves the lies. Promises to ourselves that go unfulfilled. Usually we do this to ourselves daily. When we have a habit we want to break or change. What sort of impact do you think this has on your subconscious, your conscience, and inevitably your physical well-being? You need a person who can stimulate you, motivate you, can cause radical thought, thinks outside the box, and discovers more within you. A person who can inspire you. What you need is a life discovery guide. Let's get acquainted. I'm Mark Susnow. It's time to start the process of real discovery together. Go to my website, inspirepossibility.com, to learn more. And let's get acquainted. Voice of Mark Susnow provided by an imposter. An impersonator of Mark Susnow. An actor doing Mark Susnow impersonation. Voice of Mark Susnow provided. Fuck, what do I say there? Do you ever feel there is more to life than what you are currently experiencing? Are you basically stuck in a dead-end career job or perhaps reeling from a toxic relationship? Everyone faces deep challenges in their life. That's why everyone needs a life discovery guide. Meet Mark Susnow of InspirePossibility.com and get inspired. Let Mark journey with you and show you how to navigate life's challenges as a mentor, as a guide, as a friend with immense energy to dynamically change your world. Schedule your complimentary coaching session with Mark Susnow now by visiting inspirepossibility.com and clicking contact. You have nothing to lose and only inspiration to gain. Visit InspirePossibilities.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Mark Susnow. And you're listening to a show that makes a difference, a show that inspires possibilities in your life, possibilities that maybe you haven't even thought about or haven't even considered. And my hope is that after you listen to the show, you'll have some new ideas, things that maybe you've put on the back burner, dreams that you maybe once had. And what I like to do is interview every week somebody who I hold in high esteem, somebody who I consider a cutting-edge thought leader.
And this person today is a friend of mine, somebody who I've known for years. He's an amazing individual. He's been in the field of human potential probably for 40 years. He's the former CEO of Hoffman International and the Hoffman Institute Foundation. His name is Raz Ingrassi. And welcome, Raz Ingrassi, to the Inspire Possibility Show. One of my
Thank
favorite
you, Mark.
People.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
So I hear you want to change the world today. Is that what you want to do?
I think the world is changing right before our eyes, and I think we all agree that change is one of those inevitable, always happening. You know, the only thing constant is change, and the real secret is that there is a positive side to change. There's always a positive side to change. And as you and I have discussed many times, Mark, you know, sort of the secret of a successful life is getting on the positive side of change and learning how to reside there, how to be in the sweet spot or to find the silver lining, the silver linings playbook, how to be in that positive side of change. And so, yeah, we give people a lot of support and guidance and knowledge on how to do that.
So you've been involved with the Hoffman Institute that has the Hoffman Process for quite some time now. What exactly is the Hoffman Process?
Well, the Hoffman Process is a 7-day residential intensive program. By intensive, I don't mean it's hurtful or, you know, it's a marathon. You get plenty of sleep every night, great food. But we are in a retreat site where you're not distracted by other things. And you're spending 7 days in an intense self-examination and a discovery process of what is really you and what is really not you. We're all carrying around false selves. And then we also have a sense that there is a deep, true, you know, radiant self, a self that knows your path in life and is ready to come out and make a difference. And we glimpse that, of course, every so often. I think all of us have the goal to live from that more radiant, powerful, loving self. But sometimes frequently there are things that block us from that. And so the Hoffman Process is an opportunity to distinguish your false selves from your true self and to release the attachment that you have to your false selves and to strengthen your connection to your true self and gain the capacity to live from that.
Okay, so you've said now false self and true self. Can you elaborate a little bit more about what you mean by that? Like, what do you mean by the false self and the true self? And does that have anything to do with the positive side of change?
Okay, well, first off, I'll just say that the true self, the deep self, is free, open, loving, and spontaneous. It's your true nature. It's what would be called the Buddha nature. Part of you that's connected to God, that's resonating in harmony with everything that is all the time.
So
and
that,
your true nature,
is that,
pardon?
Is that the part that's like free of judgments?
Yeah. It can discern things, truth from, you know, it can make judgments, but it's not judgmental.
Uh-huh.
It's not conditional. It's unconditionally loving.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah. And so that part of you that's unconditionally loving, which doesn't mean that it cannot make, you know, it can make judgments. It can tell truth from false. Now, then there's another aspect of ourself which has really been conditioned from before we were aware that anything was even coming in. When we were very little children, we were like sponges absorbing everything in our immediate environment, which was home. And so whatever we, you know, got from our parents became reality for us. And very few of us can remember much before about 6 years old, 6-7 years old.
Right.
That's about when the intellect kicked in and started organizing things. But if you've ever raised children, you know that a whole lot is happening, and there's a tremendous amount of development between birth and 6, 7, 8 years old. And that material, which is now kind of hidden from us behind like a curtain, is the material that we need to get a grip on, because that's where a lot of our defensive mechanisms, our ego structures were created as a way to allow us to get on in life. And of course, we've sort of updated them and modernized them and made them adaptable to our adult lives. But frankly, that's our emotional brain, and it's still running the show in a large, large measure. You know, that's the result. All the recent brain science and psychological research will show you that.
So I want to come back to this. If I understood you correctly, you're saying that we have our intellect, around six years old, our intellect starts to form, and we start creating a memory of our life from that point. But the first 6 years, we don't quite remember what happened to us those first 6 years. And those are the that are more or less
without an intellect,
how we see the world.
You and I are living a narrative of our own lives. We have a narrative, an idea. You know, you have a felt sense of who you are, and that felt sense is supported by a narrative, a story, and so it is with every person. But we can't create the narrative until you have an intellect. So before that, it's just a lot of undifferentiated things, and most of them are they're emotional experiences because, like I said, your intellect hasn't kicked in. So, So it's those things have shaped us in profound ways. And, people are carrying these reactions. And, everyone has a self that they're trying not to show to everyone else, a self that they're sort of ashamed of, that they wish was different. It's filled with fears and anxieties and different things that we are trying to overcome. And we think we can hide that from other people, but we can't hide it from ourselves, and it's there. And it's possible. What I'm saying really is that stuff was formed before your intellect was in place. You cannot change it through your intellect. It's impossible to change through your intellect. You actually have to find a way to go back into that material, and it involves very much invoking this dimension of self we call the spiritual self, and going in emotionally, and discovering self-compassion for yourself to resolve that some of that early material. I guess I want to add here that the Hoffman process is based on the idea that there are four dimensions of self that are occurring simultaneously and interactively. Of course, there's first the body, then there's these emotions, emotional self we call it, the intellect, and the spiritual self. And so these four aspects are occurring, interactively, simultaneously. And most of us, certainly in the Western world, are raised to live in our intellect. We think we are our head, and we're carrying the body. The body is just something to carry around the head. But when you get into the body, there's a wisdom of the body. There's a wisdom of the emotions, and there is a the emotional side and the spiritual self come together. There's compassionate knowledge and powerful intuitive knowledge in the spiritual self, guidance.
So,
and when you get all
so
these
Ralph,
aspects of all
Ralph,
these kinds of intelligence going at once.
Yeah. Let me see if I can understand what you're saying, okay? Is that
sure.
What I think you're saying is that most of us, our life, we perceive our life through our mind, through our thoughts. But yet there's a whole another reality there with how we feel, our emotions, our spirituality, that we're not really that aware of, or we just don't give them enough importance. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Oh yeah, very much so. People have that's it. I mean, I was just working with a guy this morning who was at a funeral of his favorite aunt, who was like a surrogate mother to him, and his own mother was very distant, and this woman was just fantastic, gave him a childhood, and yet he was at her funeral and couldn't cry. And then he got kind of upset with himself, like, why can't I feel that deep emotion? So we did some work, and he found out that he was, conditioned very early in life by his father not to feel or show emotions. So anything that comes up, he shoves it down. He's got this habit learned very early on to push it down. He thinks he can't feel, but once he's in touch with his true inner self, his emotional side, of course he can feel, but he's also got this bad habit of shoving those feelings down. So if he just gets over the learned habit, the learned behavior of shoving those things down, they can come up. And so a lot of those learned patterns that we have of behavior come from our early life and need to be. It's like walking around. Imagine if you had a 20-pound weight on each leg, you'd feel weak and clumsy. And so a lot of what happens in Hoffman is you get the weights off, and it feels totally different. So Hoffman doesn't make you stronger by building more muscles. It makes you stronger by getting rid of the weakness, getting rid of the weights. We're all carrying, sometimes it's called we're carrying around baggage. We're giving you an opportunity to actually put your baggage down and let it stay there.
Uh-huh. Right. We all got to get rid of those bags, huh?
Yeah, those emotional baggage.
Get rid of those bags. Where are they? Get rid of them. Throw them out. We don't need them. They're weighing us down. I understand that there's a lot of research now on the Hoffman. I mean, I understand, too, that they were teaching the Hoffman process at Harvard. Is that my correct understanding?
Well, I'll address both of those things. First off, yeah, there's a good deal of research on Hoffman. And in the worldwide research literature, a Hoffman process produces more lasting change for people than anything else in the research literature. And basically, it reduces what is called negative affect, depression, worry, anxiety, hostility, anger. And it increases emotional intelligence, the ability to know what I'm feeling, what you're feeling. Mm-hmm. They interact mm-hmm. appropriately. It increases spirituality, forgiveness, and compassion. And those negatives, those unwanted negative emotions, go down dramatically, and measured a year later, they're still down. The positive things go up dramatically, or significantly, as they would say in scientific jargon, and measured a year later, they've continued going up. So this is not an experience where there's a tailing off effect, where the effect lasts a little while, and you have to have a mantra to sustain it. Or something. Instead of that, it is you learn some things and it keeps improving. It keeps going up for you because it connects you to life in a new way. And life is, you have a learning experience with life. So it keeps going up. Answer your second question is, yes, we taught at Harvard from, 96 through 2010, 5 years. And we were working in the Center for Public Leadership in the Kennedy School. And the goal there was to the idea of the Kennedy School, of the Center for Public Leadership and this Kennedy School, is that authenticity is the core of leadership, and that the business of becoming a real whole person is very much the same as becoming an effective leader. And so they're looking for that authenticity, and the Hoffman process, scientifically you could say, or technically, authenticity is correlated closely to emotional intelligence. And to your following your own, knowing and following your own intuition, the best part of yourself. So Hoffman does more to bring that forward than anything else. And so it gave people a better shot at their own authenticity.
Yeah. So I hadn't actually heard that before. That's kind of interesting. You're saying that they correlated authenticity with emotional intelligence?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you're saying a person is, well, I'll ask you, Mark, when we say this person is authentic or real, what does that mean? What are you looking at? How are you measuring this person? I don't think that person's telling the truth. Or, I mean, you used to be a trial lawyer. You could have a pretty good sense of people. How do you sense whether someone's being real or not, telling the truth?
Well, I guess to me, someone's telling the truth is they're conveying what they really feel. Because a lot of times I would ask somebody a question, and I could tell by their facial expressions what they really felt before they even told me the answer. So you ask somebody, hey, do you feel that, like when I was a lawyer, do you believe in the presumption of innocence? And of course, everybody would say yes. But some people didn't. Some people felt, well, if,
some people were giving lip service
arrested,
to it without really.
Yeah, and so you could watch their facial expressions, and they would kind of, make two or three or four facial expressions before saying
well,
yes.
Let me ask you another question, Mark.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, you could look at facial expressions and body posture and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But also, I would bet that, there's a saying that the truth has a ring to it. It rings. And
yes.
And you can feel that. It resonates in your body. And so when someone's telling the truth, you can feel it. And when someone's trying to deceive you, you may not know the thing they're trying to deceive you about, but you can tell that they're trying to hide something. You can tell that they're trying to distract you. Or
I agree.
And so what I'm getting at is that's also true for leaders. And if a leader is trying to, preaching fear, is trying to distract you, trying to lead you, you can feel that. If a leader is leading from his or her heart, his passion, you feel that too. It resonates in the people's bodies, and they're going to follow someone who is speaking the truth and is authentic, feels it down to their bones, and then I can feel it down to my bones. That's emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is simply knowing what I'm feeling, getting a sense of what you're feeling, and behaving in a way that's consistent or appropriate to both of our emotional states. So when a person's emotional intelligence goes up, their leadership capacity goes way, way, way up.
Mm-hmm. I know. I also see it that, with emotional intelligence, you're also tuned in when somebody isn't really being real or authentic. I mean, I think I see it as greater than authenticity, because I think when you have emotional intelligence, you can sense what somebody's really feeling.
Even when
they're not authentic, So I don't know if I necessarily see it that way, but I never really heard that correlation. That's why I was kind of curious.
Oh yeah, the correlation is very well proven. If you study Daniel Goleman, his emotional intelligence books, the books on
they're great.
Emotional intelligence and leadership, it's all there in spades. The research is conclusive on this. And Mark, you are empathic. And you are you have a subjective relationship with people. You lead from your heart, and I bet you're a great trial attorney because you bring the truth out in the situation. You're really good at reading people. So another trial attorney who does not have emotional intelligence is just not going to be that effective. So
tell me.
Now tell you what.
I'm curious about.
That's true across the board. That's true for rocket scientists also. That's true for mathematicians and professors. Anyone who's got more emotional intelligence will be more successful in their field. And it's true in your marriage.
If you have more emotional intelligence,
you'll be more successful in your marriage.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe.
And we're raising your kids.
Maybe.
Emotional intelligence is fundamental to raising kids. Emotional intelligence is fundamental to raising kids, and it's fundamental. Increasing your emotional intelligence is an inside job. We each have the responsibility, the obligation to open our hearts, to learn to feel more deeply. You get into mind-body healing, into that field, and what you discover is that love is always associated with healing, and fear is always associated with illness. And so if you want to optimize your ability to heal, you want to move into a deeper experience of love. And how often do we, in our marriages, in our love relationships, are we being driven by fear and instead of love? And so we're trying to get some love from someone else instead of bringing love forward from ourselves.
Right. And the process, really, what it does is help people get in touch with that deep love inside themselves. Isn't that really what most people experience after they do the process? They feel their connection with that love inside of them, and they're less judgmental about themselves and more accepting
and
of themselves.
And that love place inside of you, we call your spiritual self, your emotional self, that place that is your deeper, truer self resonates spontaneously with that place in another human being.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a much greater opportunity to be successful with people. Mm-hmm. And I want to say one other thing. It's not just finding the place inside you that is love, but it's learning to love yourself. And it all starts with self-love. I think you've got something on your website about that. That's just great.
I do.
Yeah. Self-love often sounds selfish to people. But if you want to measure if you're loving toward yourself or not, Just listen to your self-talk, to your inner critic, to the one that's judging you, beating yourself up, beating you up all the time. You know how, you know, it's that old, I think it's probably 20, 30 years ago when I saw a T-shirt that said, "The beatings will continue until morale improves." And you can laugh at that. You know, you can laugh at that and think, oh, my God, you know, how many places run there? How many companies run off of that? But think about it subjectively. How often am I beating myself up trying to make myself into a better person? I think I'm deserving of all this flogging. And if you're beating yourself up, that's the opposite of self-love. So, you know, that can be shifted. That can be changed to self-appreciation,
Let me ask you another
self-gratitude. Yeah.
Right. We've been talking about self-love, the Hoffman process, and it's given in St. Helena, Northern California, near Napa. And if people want to find out more information regarding the Hoffman process, they go to the website. What is the website?
The website is just all one word, HoffmanInstitute.org. HoffmanInstitute.org.
And the trainings are given about every 2 weeks or so?
Well, we run here in the United States, there is a Hoffman process. We call it Hoffman process. Running, it's a one-week thing. It starts on a Saturday morning, ends the next Friday at around noon. It runs every other week here in Northern California, and six, seven times a year on the East Coast in a site that we don't own but we rent, so that there are over 30 opportunities a year to do it.
Uh-huh.
And I also want to mention that it's in 14 countries around the world. So,
wow.
It's in Canada, Australia, the UK, but it's also in Germany, Switzerland, France, Italy, Spain. I could name a bunch of others, but yeah, in 14 countries.
Right. So probably, it'd probably be fair to say that almost every week at some place in the world, a Hoffman process is beginning.
Oh, every week somewhere in the world, there's more than one. I mean, there are more. There's several.
Right.
But they're not all done in English. I mean, if you take it in Italy, you better speak Italian because they speak Italian, and that's why they're there. It's always done in the native language. And you know, in Venice, in Argentina, it's done in Spanish, and in Brazil, it's done in Portuguese, and like that. But in the United States, yeah, there are lots of opportunities to participate.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I'm also curious about, you'd mentioned there were several research studies out there. What are some of the more well-known ones? I'm kind of curious about that.
Okay, well, there's the University of California, probably the most well-known one, biggest one, is the University of California. They did a three-year research study following 100 people, and they had a control group. It was a grant research study, meaning that the University of California asked us for permission to research it, and they own all the data. So they're going to publish. It's conducted by professors in the psychology department. They own all the data, so they're going to publish whether the results are good or bad. So it was. We had no control over this thing. And and so then it showed, as I said, these significant decreases in unwanted emotional content, affect, hostility, anger. It's called, they call it depression. It's, you could think of it as sadness, feeling blue, and anxiety, which is being worrisome. A very significant, and that stuff dropped for mild to moderate depression, which is what most people who are medicated are experiencing. That drops like a rock and stays down. A year later, it's still down. Then the positive things, the things we want more of, emotional intelligence, compassion, forgiveness, love, spirituality, those things went up. And measured 3 months later, they had continued going up, and measured a year later, they had gone up even higher still. I liken that to learning how to ride a bike. You know, learning to ride a bike is not an intellectual experience. But once we all remember that moment when we could balance, we could ride the bike, ride a two-wheeler. But really, once you can't get better at it until you can do it. So once you can ride a bike, the more you ride, the better you are. And similarly, once you get these basic things in your beingness, in your entire dimension of self, in your body, in your intellect, your emotions, in your spirit, you're more whole. And just the process of living life continues to expand it, because you can't help but practice it every day. So it goes up. Emotional intelligence goes up. Spirituality goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Connectivity goes up. Health goes up. And vitality and energy go up. All those things were measured by the University of California. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for being my guest. I always find that our
Mark,
conversations
is a pleasure.
Are stimulating, insightful, empowering, and you certainly know a lot about this field. As I said before when I introduced you, you've been in this field longer than anybody I know, since your early 20s, and you're a real pioneer. And I'm just waiting, for you to have your book out, whenever that is.
Hey, Mark,
whenever you decide.
That's
to
great. Thank
write
you.
One.
You know, you and I are famously take long walks, and I have talked endlessly about all these topics, and it's kind of fun to be talking to you and letting other people, imagining other people are overhearing us. So
absolutely.
Thanks for this chance.
Absolutely.
All right.
Right. Exactly. They're in our into our room of private thoughts. So thank you, everybody.
They're in our room.
Tuning into the show today, and next week we're going to have another great guest, as we usually do. And in the meanwhile, journey on.
You've been listening to Inspire Possibility Show with Mark Susnow. To learn more about Mark Susnow, go to inspirepossibility.com and click on the contact button. Schedule a complimentary visit with Mark or email him at mark@inspirepossibility.com. Imagine the possibilities. 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 Imagine the possibilities.